What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the Vacation Rental Revolution Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Moore. We're back with Whiskey Wednesday, my main man, Jake Sheehy.
Yes.
We're talking about a little of everything, but specifically hot topics and how it's going to affect your short-term rental investing journey. Mm-hmm. Those of you that are new to this show, that is our goal, is to help you walk into the short-term rental investing game with your eyes wide open. And so, Jake, what do we have on our agenda today?
Some great stuff today.
There's some things affecting travel, right?
Yes, sir. Great day to be alive,
I'm assuming. I almost know what we're going to talk about today.
You know what we're talking about. All right, so we have an opening question. We have to go with that first. Yeah. But then we're talking about oil prices. Seems a little odd, but it definitely affects how people travel.
Yeah.
It affects gas prices, airfare costs, all these things. We're going to talk about that. Then we have this amazing study that came out. Of course, global travel surging. Great numbers coming out. But could this also be affected? We'll kind of go into these.
Yeah,
we got these three things: opening question, oil prices, and then global travel are our three main things that we're talking about.
Awesome,
very exciting stuff. Let's do this opening question, huh?
Okay,
let me read this thing. Kind of, I appreciate it for people sending these in. Support at Vodacy.com. Make sure you send in your questions, we'll get them answered on the show. Here we go. I'm currently renovating a house and having Mike do design and full setup. My realtor also manages short-term rentals, so I was planning on having him manage, but when we sent him the contract, he wants to own the listing and have all funds sent to him, cutting me a check after expenses each month. This feels like a way to hold me hostage with him owning my listing. My other two short-term rentals, I own the listings and receive the funds from OTAs, and my co-host bill me each month, which I prefer. What are your thoughts on owning your listing versus your property manager owning your listing and all reviews that would stay with them if you ever changed co-host/PMs? Thanks, Eric.
Okay, Eric, awesome question and a very common one that we get all the time. We actually haven't had it for a minute, so I appreciate you sending it in. I will tell you before I answer in a long-winded way, I don't own any of my listings. And so I hire property managers on all my properties, and I don't own any of the listings. They own them. And so it is not uncommon for property managers that so you're used to dealing with co-hosts. Usually the big difference between a property manager and a co-host is many states, you have to be licensed to be a property manager. One of the big things that you have to be licensed for is to handle other people's money. And so property managers, like you mentioned, they own the listing, the money comes to them, and then they pay you at the end of every month. You're used to the co-host, which is going to be co-hosting with you. You own the listing, they're a co-host on it. They handle a lot of the duties and responsibilities of the property manager. But then what happens is the money comes to you, and then they send you a bill at the end of every month, you pay it out. So you're used to that relationship. Because of that, you're saying, hey, listen, I prefer that. And now, I don't think the property manager is going to hold you hostage. You're going to be, that is a normal way for property managers to do business. You're exactly right, though. If you change, you lose your reviews, you lose the listing, and you're going to be starting over with somebody else. Now, that, in my opinion, is not as big of a deal as most people make it. I've been operating this way for years. It's never been a massive problem for me. Usually we have really good property managers that we're going to be with for a long time. And if we leave them, it might be a little painful. We might have to start over, but usually I'm only leaving them if there's a problem. Most of the time, problems arise in the very beginning with a property manager. So I'm usually going to figure out those problems before I have a really good listing with tons of great reviews. If I have a good listing with a lot of reviews, that is, that's what I want the property manager to do. So why would I move on? Now, if you anticipate managing your own property in the future or being able to like jump into the management side of it, then I might suggest more of a co-host relationship instead of a straight property management relationship, because a property manager, 9 out of 10 times, they're going to own the listing. Some of them will give you the option. And if it's important to you, you could say, hey, listen, I want you to property manage, but I want to own the listing, and then you can co-host it so that if something happens, I can keep that listing in those reviews. If a property manager is not doing their good job, many times you don't want that listing, because if they're not doing a good job delivering a great experience, you're going to get bad reviews. You're going to have a listing that you really don't want, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to say, hey, listen, I want to start over. And I've never felt like it's a big deal to start over. I've never felt like that's a massive you know, I can get those reviews really fast. I can get the momentum. We know exactly what it takes. We've got the blueprint. And so I don't really worry about that too much. And it is not a property manager versus a co-host relationship. That's going to be the biggest difference. Is the property manager many times, most of the time, is going to own the listing. Now, some of them will work with you. Some of them will say, hey, listen, I'm okay, you know, manage, or I'm okay with you owning the listing. But also, they may or may not be okay with that either because of how they run their business with their standard operating procedures. They might say, hey, listen, we have a host account. It's already got a lot of a really good reputation. It's already got a ton of reviews in our hosting account. And so it puts us in an advantage when we start to bring other properties on within that account, right? And so they may, you know, reviews are the lifeblood of the business. They're going to want those in their account as well. However, one of the things that we always say with our property managers, we have kind of three non-negotiables. One of them is we want to pay for and own our own photos. And so if that listing, if they keep the listing, they can't use your photos. Like whatever, like not that they're going to use your photos because it's the same property, but you have all the marketing assets, if you will, all the property photos that you invested in. We call them lifestyle photography. And so we're going to create this immersive, you know, articulate this story really, really well through lifestyle photography. I'm going to own those. And so even if I have to go start over, gaining the first reviews and gaining that momentum is really not that big of a deal. I think that people make a bigger deal of it than it is, or it feels like it's a bigger deal. Most of the time you have to think about strategically, why do you want to keep the listing if it is, hey, listen, I'm going to build up all these great, I'm going to have 100 five-star reviews. Well, if that's the case, you're probably not switching property managers unless you're going to pull it and you want to do it yourself. So if your long-term goal is to manage the property yourself, then maybe you want to own the listing. But if it's because, well, what if something goes wrong and I'm at odds with the property manager, they're not doing a good job, and I want to keep that listing and it's got all those great reviews. Well, if they're not doing a good job, you're not going to have a lot of great reviews, and you're usually going to find those problems out in the very beginning of that relationship with the property manager. If you have a problem, it's usually going to be in the first.
Okay, so in my opinion, this makes kind of, it sounds like maybe he's not like fully confident or comfortable in this person. I mean, if you're like, if you trust this guy and he's got or a woman and they have amazing reviews, it doesn't seem like it would be that big of a deal to let him own it. Should he like interview him more, or should he try?
Possibly. And I think it's more the relationship he's had in the past where it's with co-hosts, and you're used to owning that listing. You're used to letting them be a co-host. Some property managers will do that. Maybe it's just as simple as asking. And you don't lose out on a good property manager. Yeah. If you already went through the interviews that we suggest, and you've already checked off all the boxes that we suggest, and then you see the contract that they actually own the listing, most property managers are going to operate that way. That is how most property managers operate. And the difference, and that's one of the big differences. I mean, it's usually the main difference, is who handles the money on the front end. A property manager is going to be licensed in most areas to be a property manager. Like most states, you actually have to be, not every state, but most states, you have to be licensed to be a property manager. And that means you're taking somebody else's funds, you're holding their funds, and you're going to pay them out, right? And so that's where they own the listing. It's tied to their bank account. The money comes in, and they send you your cut at the end of every month. A co-host relationship is the opposite. You own the listing. It's tied to your bank account. The money comes to you, and then the co-host sends you a bill, and you pay them every month of what they were doing. That is the main difference. And the ownership of that listing, the reason they own the listing is because it's tied to their bank account. They're taking the money, everything else. And so accounting wise, it's just much easier for them. It's how their businesses are set up. They're licensed to do so. And so I've never found it a big deal. It's how I operate every single one of my properties. I've never owned my own listings. And I actually have one property manager that allows us to own our own listings, and we choose not to. We say, hey, just keep it under your account. You've got a great reputation. They're already super hosts. They've got a ton of five-star reviews, like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds that we can kind of get a little bit of benefit from, especially in the beginning, and they do a great job.
Oh, wow. Okay. That answers it to me. In my opinion, I felt like that was fantastic. Yeah. Don't be too worried about it.
Yeah. It's not something I worry about. I don't think that it is that a lot of people, I think, worry about it on the front end. But think about where your worst case scenario is, and think about your long-term goals. I will say, if your long-term goal is to ultimately maybe own this, the listing, and self-manage, and you're going to pull the management away, then maybe you go with a co-host.
Right. Okay. All right, let's go into oil prices and how they're affecting travelers' wallets. All right, let's go into this. So we have these two points, and they kind of may coexist a little bit, may weave in and out of them a little bit, but here we go. So for just a little quick stat, oil prices just went over $115 a barrel. That's higher than it was during COVID. So this is huge because it affects gas prices. It affects airline ticket travel. It affects some things, right? So we're going to kind of go into here. So If I'm owning an Airbnb, I own a short-term rental, should I be kind of worried if I have a drive-to destination? I mean, you know, even drive-to destinations or fly-to destinations, do you think both of these are going to be like really impacted by this? Or do you think like, you know, this is a good time for people to honestly get away from like this, from this kind of crazy time?
So, well, one, oil prices affect travel. Mm-hmm. And we'll break down where I think they affect some good, some bad.
Okay.
And so, yeah, we've seen a spike with the Iran war that saying, hey, listen, oil prices above 150 or hit 115 a barrel. I don't know exactly where they're at today, but I think I think they're over $100 a barrel for sure, and going up since the Iran war started. If this is a prolonged war, this could be, you know, if it prolongs, let's first say, like, most recessions are preceded by oil prices spiking. Now, usually, like, this is the oil prices are spiking because of the war, right? And instantly went up, right? Like almost overnight. And so we're feeling it at the pump, and we haven't felt it long term yet at the pump. And so the longer it goes, the more it affects a lot of these things we're going to talk about. Short term, when we're driving, and we always love drive to destinations. We think that they're the most recession proof. We think we are insulated from the ups and downs in the markets way more than markets like the markets like, let's say, Hawaii or the Caribbean, the islands. Right, you're not driving to any of those markets. You have to fly. Right, airlines. Air travel, the airline's biggest expense, up to like 20% of their operating expenses, is gas prices. So when gas prices significantly spike, well, guess what? That gets passed down to ticket prices. Ticket prices go up. And so if it costs me, you know, if I'm flying over somewhere for $1,000 and now all of a sudden it goes to $1,500 and I got a family of five, that's a big increase in my cost to travel to one of those destinations that I'm flying to. So fly to destinations are affected the most when oil prices spike. Drive-to destinations, on the other hand, are not as affected, because let's assume you're a 4 to 6 hour drive away. Most of your cars, let's say it cost you, you know, it's $100 in gas to get there, and then all of a sudden they spike and it goes up to $150 a gas. In gas. So your cost of travel went up by $50. In the airline example, let's say that same ratio took your $1,000 ticket to up $500 across however many people you're traveling with. And so that the drive to destinations, oil prices affect them almost negligible. We don't notice it as much as a consumer. So we don't like it. I don't like spending, you know, that much more, you know, 50% more to fill up my tank of gas. But at the end of the day, if you really break it down, it doesn't stop me from going.
Right.
But if I have an increase in my trip of $3,000 or $2,500 or whatever it is, that 500 times however many people are in your family, a couple thousand dollars might say, I don't know, that's just on getting there. Right. And so drive to destinations, which again, we see the most insulation against these types of things happening on drive to destinations. Fly to destinations, different story. This is a fairly short, like this, they spiked and we'll see how long it lasts. The longer it lasts, the more effect it's going to have on international travel, fly to destinations, of saying, hey, listen, if I'm in an area where people, the majority of people, have to get on a plane to get here. That could be
a tough one.
That can be a tough one.
Yeah.
The longer it lasts. And so short term, you will start to have consumers, like, you know, not affected as much on the drive to destinations. They'll start to think about the fly to destinations. But short term, a lot of those travelers right now are already booking trips, right? And so they've already maybe paid for their trips.
Interesting.
And so they're still going, right? Yeah. Medium term, people are going to start to choose domestic travel over, of the domestic drive-to travel over fly-to destinations. And then long-term, it could have a much greater effect on the economy as a whole, recessionary times, some of those things.
Interesting. Okay. I mean, quick article here. We have Independent. They just released this today. Cost of flight surges up to 7 times higher as oil crisis hits airlines. So, yeah. I mean, that's a giant number. Now, I saw this other
article. See that? So that makes no sense. So
talk
so
to me.
Here's where I don't like I get prices of travel are going to go up.
Right.
And, but how do you surge 7 times when your largest expense is fuel, but it's only accounts for about 20% of your operating expenses? Like that, I mean,
they're probably just passing it on, man.
But passing on and taking advantage that, I mean, you jump 7 times, like maybe I don't understand the economics, but in my head, if you're like, go look up, why don't you look up what's the,
all right.
What is the, let's see, airline is their largest expense is what percentage of operating cost is fuel for an airline?
I love it when we break stuff down like this. This is fantastic. Yeah. What percentage of operating cost is, do you say, is oil?
Is fuel.
Is fuel for an airline. Huh. Let's check this out. 20 to 30%.
20-30%. Okay, so yeah.
Wow. Oh, now I'm interested.
Yeah, so it could rise to 40% in high oil times. Mm-hmm. But you're taking it from 20 to 30% to 40%. We're not 7x-ing our oil cost, right?
Yeah.
And so we're jumping it, but anyways, that's just we didn't read the article. We just read headlines, which
I know, you shouldn't just read
headlines, right?
And it just sounded really good.
Yeah.
Okay, now here's another point I was curious about. I saw this other thing when it says right here. Now, of course, this could just be another headline here, so I want to break this down. When gas prices rise, short-term rental hosts should expect even shorter, more spontaneous, and closer-to-home stays, kind of like we said with the drive-to mm-hmm. destination. Should these people with maybe like a cabin, treehouse, these kinds of things, should they expect, you know, people maybe just shortening their length, or do you think that's kind of just another like headline that people
are trying to... Yeah, I don't see, like, drive-to destinations are, again, not going to be... Mm-hmm. When you really think about your cost of fuel to a drive-to destination, you're adding a couple hundred bucks maybe to your cost of the entire trip.
Right.
So I don't see consumer behavior being swayed one way or the other on that as much.
Okay.
Right. You're going to feel the effects of the high oil prices if you're a commuter or you're every day you're having to fill up your car. Hmm. So certain. You know, people in, you know, like we live in Utah, things are spread out. We spend more probably on gas than somebody that lives in an urban area.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
Because we're driving around a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to feel the effects of that. But if I'm going up to Yellowstone for the weekend, mm-hmm. If I was planning on going to Yellowstone, I'm still going to Yellowstone. It's going to cost me an extra $100 to get up and back, mm-hmm. you know, maybe $50 each way, but it's not an extra couple grand like the airlines are going up. So that's why I don't think those travel, and we've seen it. Look mm-hmm. at oil prices during COVID were over $100 a barrel.
Right. Yeah.
And so, and where flourished like crazy. One, there was travel restrictions on airlines. Mm-hmm. And so you had travel restrictions with the airlines coupled with really high cost to fly places. And mm-hmm. so drive to destinations just absolutely exploded through mm-hmm. COVID.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah. We've already seen now, you know, when you go into these wars and you go into these different things that are happening, mm-hmm. the American consumer is really resilient. It's almost like we wake up every day and there's something else we're dealing with, right? And so it's like, so it's really sad to say that we're kind of hardened to the fact that the ups and downs of everything that's going on, we just are going to live our lives.
Yeah,
at the end
on.
Of the day, you pretty much have to go out there and live your life. And we've seen that, especially from the American consumer, not making massive, you know, life changes mm-hmm. overall. We're still pretty much doing what we're doing. And part of that, I think, is just because, I mean, we're like living in chaos.
Yeah,
like we're used to it, right? And we're bombarded with it. Now, I do, long-term, mm-hmm. And we'll have to see. The jury's out how long this thing's going to last. It's supposed to be short-lived. Mm-hmm. I hope it is. And, you know, I hope we get things squared away to where we get back in, mm-hmm. in just back to normal. If this is a long, drawn-out war, you know, I think the conversation's a little bit different.
Yeah.
I think that you're starting to talk about recession and things like that. That those things usually are, you know, precede a recession if oil prices surge like that mm-hmm. and different things are causing the economy mm-hmm. to falter a little bit.
Interesting. All right, what about this now? Let's go into maybe someone's listening to this and they go, man, you know, the average family, they're having, this is a little bit more cost for them. Should I bump my prices down a little bit just to help them, you know, eat some of that cost and maybe help me kind of stand out a little bit, showing a discount maybe?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing that we always talk about, right? If you feel like you have to do that, then you didn't do the other things correctly on the front end. In the absence of value that you're providing, you have to talk about cost, right? And so there's the consumers always has this cost versus value, you know, conversation in their head going. And so if I'm not articulating more value than my competitors, then I better start thinking about lowering prices. If I'm not, you know, but consumers, if you show them the value you have, you show them and articulate that you have something different, something unique, something personal to them, then they're willing to pay you more. And again, I don't think that we, you know, we just haven't seen consumer behavior change a lot during these times outside of, you know, maybe some fly to destinations, international travel, some of those things I think suppress a little bit. But, you know, domestic drive to destinations seem to fare very well during these times.
Yeah. Let's go into the last one here. Cancellations. Okay. Maybe worst comes to worst, they just can't, they can't afford it, they can't handle it, right? And they got to cancel. Do you think this is a refundable request, or do you think when I say cancellations, do you immediately think like, no, don't refund them, or do you think like, nah, just give it back to them, or where does your head go with
that? Yeah, mine is different than almost, I don't know anybody does what I do. We have a 24-hour cancellation policy on all of our properties. Like, that's unheard of. If any reason you want to cancel, you cancel. Mm-hmm. You can't come, don't come. Mm. We use it on the marketing side to stand out. We give the consumers a lot of confidence when they're booking an expensive trip to say, hey, listen, I can book, you know, I can book Jake's property and I can only cancel with him within 30 days. But what if something happens? Sean's letting me cancel within 24 hours. And, you know, everything else being equal, I'm picking Sean's property, right? Mm. So we use it on the marketing side a lot. I think it matters, you know, everybody has a different opinion on cancellation policies. Mine is a very, very flexible. I really go out and try to match the hotel industry. You cancel within 24 hours, you get your money back. That is almost unheard of in the short-term rental world. And so, and I get it. I'm not here to tell everybody they should do what we do. In fact, almost none of our, I don't know any other of one of our members that does what I do. And so, it goes back to your policy. The question is this a cancelable like request? No, if you've got a strict cancellation policy, it's not, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I would argue that like natural disasters and hurricanes and stuff are more, you know, legitimate to cancel over than gas prices going up, right? Mm-hmm. And so it is, but it goes down to follow your policy, follow what what you feel like is the best cancellation policy for you. I'm a very, very flexible cancellation policy.
Interesting. Okay. Very interesting. Now this is going to kind of tie into it, especially with the travel. We see this amazing headline. This is fantastic from Forbes. Global tourism reached 1.52 billion international travelers in 2025, one of the highest levels ever recorded. So we're thinking, oh, this is fantastic, right? But how much of the demand is actually going into these short-term rentals, and how much is it really going to be affected with these prices, right? So once again, we kind of hear this the same thing that there's so much chaos information that that people are just going to continue to travel no matter what. But I guess I'm kind of curious on like, do you think it's the same with other things like hotels, I guess? Do you think across the board it's just going to continue to grow? Or do you think with just the amount of stuff going on, it's really going to impact short-term rentals or hotels or the travel industry across the board?
Well, I think that like this with international travel, you know, in 2025, you figure, think about what we were just talking about. Where were gas prices in 2025?
Mm-hmm.
Low.
Yeah.
Low, right? I mean, They were on like they, you know, drill baby drill. Trump was bringing those prices down, and then he just erased all those. All of that in a weekend, right?
Yeah.
But those gas prices, oil prices, were really low through 2025. What was the average price per barrel in 2025? And that's going to be a direct reflection of airline tickets, right?
Right.
And so international travel became more affordable. If I'm buying, you know, family of four, family of five, and I'm buying an airline ticket,
69, dude.
So you're close to double that,
Yeah.
And so airline flights were more affordable. Mm-hmm. Fuel was cheap. And so that brought the prices down for airline travel, and it made international travel more attractive. And now the demand is there. Consumers want to go visit a lot of these places. We have to say, can we afford to do that? Right. And so as fuel cost spike and airline tickets spike, especially international tickets, those are your more expensive tickets. They you know, you're spending a lot more, and that fuel cost is going to be jumping those flight costs up quite a bit. And so you're saying, hey, listen, while 2025 might have been a great banner year for international travel, if this last longer than very short term blip, mm-hmm. 2026 could be an opposite headline.
Oh, wow.
And so, I think it greatly could affect international travel, where, I mean, look at over, you know, you got people, the international travel, like over to Dubai, and, you know, they're not going right now. Right. No. So it's affecting people are like pausing. They're not going. They're mm-hmm. we're that's a regional, like they're affected by the actual war, but just economically, if it's going to cost you an extra $3,000 of airline for your airline tickets to go somewhere internationally for your family, you may or may not go. You might say, hey, listen, we're going to hold off. Maybe it's an extra $5,000. Well, who knows what it is. If it's a big international flight, those oil prices are affecting it. So yeah, you could, that's great for 2025. Mm. Something we were just talking about again, could be an opposite headline for 2026. If this extends.
I'm so curious now. That's a fantastic point. Cause now I'm thinking, maybe we have less international travelers coming here or even going out, but I wonder if we keep the money inside the U.S. that maybe people don't want to go down to Mexico anymore, and people don't want to go to these other places anymore. If this war keeps going on, if other places start to become affected, I wonder if just, you know, it's very local. If the local, or not when I say local, but just U.S. kind of grows.
Yeah. You could have a boom in drive to domestic travel.
Yeah.
Some of these international areas are affected, significantly, mm-hmm. right? I mean, Mexico is a great example. I mean, I don't know how much Mexican travel has subsided from the U.S. going down to Mexico with some of the problems with the cartels down there. I don't know if people are nervous about that or not nervous about that. I haven't seen the consumer sentiment on it, but like we feed that market, let's say Europe though. Let's mm-hmm. say we're over in Europe.
Okay.
Europe also has domestic travelers. Even mm-hmm. though they're international throughout Europe, there's a lot of drive-to areas throughout Europe, true. Right? And so you could still be fed mm-hmm. in your own country. The issue for a lot of these other areas outside of the U.S., to your point, keeping the money in the U.S., we are by far and away the largest consumer base in the world, mm-hmm. right? And so we feed so many other places. And if we're not feeding those places and we keep the money here, maybe there's a little bit of a boom mm-hmm. like we saw during COVID. Yeah. I mean, that was a good example of let's keep the money in the U.S. and travel within the U.S., mostly because of restrictions, mostly because of cost, all those different things, more restrictions than anything else.
Mm. Oh, man, this is kind of exciting. Okay, well, let me read these two headlines to you. Mm-hmm. I want to get your opinion on them. Okay, so we have two things here. Key 2025, last year, price and fee changes. Here we go. Rate increases as of May 2025, the national average daily rate, ADR, grew significantly by 24.88% compared to the previous year. Fantastic, I think, right? Mm-hmm. Luxury surge. Luxury listings saw a 5.23 increase in ADR in 2025, while budget options saw a 0.33 decline per AirDNA. And so this, I feel like this just goes back to everything you've been preaching for a while now here. But when you hear that, does that like get you excited? Are you like, yeah, that's just what we've known that, man.
Yeah. We feel that, right? Yeah. Like we feel that every day. And so like, what do I tell people all the time? If you're going to play this game, play at the top, mm-hmm. you know, this is not a game in the bottom, but that is across the board. Budget consumers on budget properties, a lot of times, I mean, they're so price conscious, and it's just as hard to deal with that person who's really price conscious as it is. In fact, sometimes I think more difficult to deal with the budget minded traveler than it is a luxury traveler. And you make a heck of a lot more money. You know, when you solve rich people problems, you make, you know, you become a rich person, right? Yeah. And so when you solve poor people problems, it's, a lot of times, unless you're doing it at a massive, massive scale, which we're not in the short-term rental world, we just don't have the scale, mm-hmm. Because there's big companies that solve poor people problems, but their margins are razor thin, and they do it at such a volume that they can make good money. We're not that in short-term rentals. And so what happens is you become a commodity, you become judged on price. It's a really hard, frustrating game to play. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that the top of the market's growing and the bottom of the market's declining. What do we say all the time on this podcast? I say the gap, the biggest trend that nobody's talking about, and you just brought it up, and mm-hmm. a lot of people aren't seeing, is the gap between the top and the bottom is widening significantly. And there's this really messy middle that's just getting lumped into the bottom, not the top.
Wow. Okay, now I kind of want to transition into other forms of travel and stays, because I'm just curious and thinking that maybe a listener maybe are like, well, you say like there's a lot of travel, but then maybe they're like including hotels, or maybe they're including, what other stuff. So I kind of want to just hit on it. I just typed in here into Google two different things. First one was, did hotels grow in revenue in 2025? Did short-term rentals have revenue growth in 2025? Let's read the one about hotels first. Mm-hmm. U.S. hotel revenue growth in 2025 was sluggish and varied by segment, with overall industry RevPAR, we kind of feel iffy about RevPAR, but showing minimal, flat, or even slightly negative growth.
Now I will say that RevPAR on the hotel world is a very relevant stat.
Oh, interesting.
Like, yeah. So it's revenue per available room, right? Uh-huh. And so it is, I mean, they have that stat because of the hospitality hotel world. We try to translate it to short-term rentals, and I don't find it nearly as applicable, but RevPAR in hotel is a very good indicator of how the market's doing. And you're saying it's been very stable, flat market.
Flat. Right? All right, let's see here. Yes, the U.S. short-term rental market experienced revenue growth in 2025, driven by rising demand, increased average daily rates, and a stabilization of occupancy rates. I mean, it's fantastic, right?
Yeah.
So now I'm curious, if somebody's listening and they go, once again, but the travel has a lot of hotels and stuff in it.
Yeah.
Do you think, I mean, I feel like, and we've kind of talked about this before, so I'm it's in the back of my mind where you said, I mean, maybe like a year ago, that people who stay in hotels and people who stay in Airbnbs are different. They want different things most of the time. So it's kind of, so if somebody's thinking about this, should they think, I feel like this can maybe be kind of a dumb question, but should they think like, how could I feed both, like how could I attract the hotel person?
Yeah, so it's difficult. Okay. Hotels are going to do hotels better than you're going to do hotels in an Airbnb. And so where you see the most crossover is if you've got own a property that's in a, like a condo, a townhome, like a more of like a, in the urban centers, like in the middle of the action, and it's a small, maybe, studio, one bedroom.
Okay.
You're going to compete with the hotels. You got to be closer to prices, right? And so but at the end of the day, they're different products. And so it's why is one of them, and you stop reading that short of the 10% increase, right? One's flat and reporting nearly 10% year over year revenue growth on the other one.
I should have read that part.
And so that's a-
Hold on. And RevPAR rising by 12.7%.
Yeah. So RevPAR is going up. Okay. Total revenue is going up 10. Yeah. And so we're seeing this revenue growth, and we've been seeing, it's almost like a very predictable 10% every single year. That's a massive amount of growth for the size of the short-term rental market. But realizing that they are two different markets, and they're for two different things. Mm-hmm. And hotels are going to do better for the hotel customer. Like I'm going in, I got to fly into Dallas for a wedding. Mm-hmm. And I'm flying in on Sunday, wedding Sunday afternoon, flying back Monday. Mm. Makes zero sense for me to go get a short-term rental because of cleaning fees and everything else. I might like the short-term rental better, but I'm going to be a quick in and out. I'd rather just pay my fee, be out of there, do the hotel stay. It's right close to where I need to be.
Right.
Everything's predictable, right? Mm-hmm. And so business travelers, in and out travelers, small, like a single, like I'm going in by myself. Mm-hmm. Like it makes sense, right? And so if I'm going with my family and maybe I'm going on vacation and I've got five or six of us and I need to get three hotel rooms instead of one. And we're trying to be there for 3 to 4 or 5 days, however long we're going to be on our vacation, and we want to be hanging out together. All like we might want to eat together without going out to restaurants. Well, now all of a sudden my option is a short-term rental, right? And so short-term rental is a much better option than multiple hotel rooms.
Right.
And so there, the like people like think that they're the same. They're not. They're both hospitality, but they're really not. Your consumer's completely different. And we are, we usually do both. Like I stay in hotels for many different reasons. And I like, I'll stay at a short-term rentals when I go with my family. When I go on work trips, almost always I'll stay in hotels because I'm usually speaking at a conference. I'm going to stay at the conference hotel. I'm going to be in and out. I don't need to, I'm going to be eating out every single time. And so I'm not really there. I'm there to sleep and I'm there to get in and out.
Right. I mean, yeah, this is just, this is personal. So this is my personal style here, but I would, well, as you're talking, I'm like, yeah, when I go on a vacation, when I'm, when I want to relax, when I want to do stuff, I do short-term rentals. But when it's very fast, or when it's, when I'm just going in and out, like you said, or almost business, work, quote unquote work business, it seems like hotels. So I, okay. So is it even worth kind of comparing the two? Like, and like,
well, it, I mean, it's, well, I think it's worth what you pulled up to show that they're different like markets. Numbers. I mean, that clearly indicates they're totally different markets. One's flat, one's growing. So what is that telling you about consumer behavior, right? And so it is, you know, consumers are continuing to say we like short-term rentals better, especially on the leisure side. You're going to find it more and more on the leisure side that consumers are leaning more toward that.
Okay. Okay. I feel like that's about it. I think that's about pretty much everything I have. We're at 36 minutes. Do you want to do any long-term projections or opinions on anything? What do you think? What do you think about 2026 if you had to do one? If you had,
I'm very bullish on 2026 for a couple reasons. I think that the consumer, so I think that the consumer is spending a lot of money on the short-term rental side. We're seeing, you know, some really good indicators that if you figure out, which we have, how to stand out in these markets, how to create these immersive experiences, that a lot of the actual investors, the hosts, are lagging behind significantly right now, like more than I've seen. Like it felt like the hosts got way better from basically COVID till about 2024, 2025. You know, they got, they just, there was this expansion of everybody got better. They became more professional. The standard was raised. Now we hit this like 2024, early 2025, where the bar has been here and not a lot of people are going that next step up on the bar, right? And so it is, I'm really bullish that that we have a real good competitive advantage on the back end with a lot of money being spent for us. I'm also bullish on the investor side because there's a lot of really good buys right now. And the actual investor buyer is reading the news, reading the headlines. We just talked about, I just posted in our group that only 17% of consumers feel like now is a good time to buy. And so
17%?
17%. Lowest it's been a long time. And so that is, in my head, a massive opportunity to be go take advantage of like people, like Warren Buffett. You know, be greedy when others are fearful and fearful when others are greedy. And the consumer is really fearful right now. So it's our time to be greedy as investors. And historically, it shows that this is, it indicates that at least my prediction is this is going to be, we're going to look back and say, man, that was a good time to buy. And so I think that we can stack some really quality assets this year. So I think there's a lot of good things to be, looking forward to now. Is the how long is the war last? I think those are major things that could happen. I'm really hopeful and that it's going to be short lived, and that we get in and out. But the longer it drags on, the more effect it's going to have on a lot of different things. And so it is, that's something to watch. But there's always things to watch.
There's always something going on. That's exactly what I was going to say. There's literally always something.
I don't pay too much attention to that outside of, the major things that are going on with oil prices going up, things like that. But at the end of the day, we pay really close attention to what is the consumer doing? How is it affecting them? And all of those, all that turmoil is affecting consumers on buying houses. They don't think it's a good time to buy. Everybody's waiting. Everybody thinks the bubble's going to burst, right? Yeah. What I had a little project for you that we haven't pulled out yet, right? Right. I had you go back 10 years and pull all the articles telling us, and I said, go find all these articles. Every single year, they're saying the bubble's going to burst. Mm-hmm. The real estate market's going to crash, right?
This is the year. This is the year. You got to watch out. Yeah.
Right? Wasn't it interesting when you were doing that?
I know.
Like just seeing that, like for a decade.
Well, it was also interesting to see how many people, how many owners or whoever, like the publishers, would continue to keep publishing that year after year. Like it's like, oh, people really like this article, so let's just do it again this year.
Let's just repeat the article.
So, and it's they just reworded it.
They just changed the dates on it.
I know. Yeah. And so I thought that was really interesting. But yeah, man, for over 10 years, I bet you could just literally keep going. But that was wild to see how many people just keep thinking, this is the year. It's all going to come crashing. But all right, that's a good prediction. Okay. That's all we got for today. But
yeah, mark it down. I think this is going to be a really
I think so too. I'd love to see
you. I'm very bullish, which is a very contrarian viewpoint because it's just easier to be bearish on the market, right? Yeah.
So, well, I'm excited. This is going to be a good year.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. Awesome, guys. Well, listen, we'll wrap it up today. We appreciate you spending your time with us. We know it's valuable. We always appreciate you spending it with us. And so if you had any value out of this show, you got any value, you think that maybe somebody else you know might get some value, we'd love you to share the show. Those things help us. We don't run ads or sponsorships, so the only way it grows always is a reminder that you guys have to share it. And also, subscribe. We started running some stats and realizing that we have a lot of listeners that don't subscribe to the show. Those things really help us. And so if you subscribe, again, that's almost your way of giving us that thumbs up or that review. And so the algorithm knows other people like you to put it in front of. And so subscribe and follow us on whatever platform you're watching or listening on. Those things are really helpful. And so I didn't realize that. I heard PBD talking about that. I said, well, hey, well, let's look at that on our site. And it's amazing how many people listen but don't subscribe or follow. And so do us a favor and follow or subscribe so that algorithm can keep helping this show grow. And so that's your way of doing your part of paying it forward, because we're not going to bombard you with ads and sponsorships. You have to listen to me for 30 seconds at the end of every episode, do my little push. But the final most important thing I ask you at the end of every episode, pick that one thing you can do today, start building that life you don't want to take a vacation from. Cheers, my friends.
Cheers.
Cheers, buddy.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Vacation Rental Revolution podcast. Share this with other people you think need to hear about it. And don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. Hey Grace, is there a website? Yes! For more amazing content and expert advice, visit Vodacy.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.